to fit sort of loosely into your graph of connections. Well, I feel like even from quantum expanders, which were sort of off at this corner, I'm sort of trekking even further to the wilderness of quantum computer randomness. But I feel like that's the way to put this work on quantum expanders, which maybe Jens will say a little bit more about, into context. This is based loosely on these papers and some upcoming work. And some of this is with my student Richard Lowe and collaborator Matt Hastings. So I'm going to talk about quantum pseudo-randomness. And the rough idea, which is also the outline for this talk, is random unitaries are really great. Hard distributed ones do all kinds of nifty things. Many of us have spent a lot of time coming up with wonderful things they can do, but they're effectively impossible to make on a quantum computer, because just like a random function is impossible to make on a classical computer, it takes too many bits of randomness, too many gates. So pseudo means fake. We can, well, on a, maybe on like one qubit, but not on n qubits. Yeah, you'd think you would be able to.
That's good enough.
But the picking the random one is surprisingly tricky. For one thing, to even implement it in out of 1 and 2 qubit gates takes exponential time, even if you could pick it. It is strange. Like, one thing you should meditate on is that there are rock, paper, scissors championships with people who rely on them do well. And picking random n qubit unitaries is even harder. And then I'm going to conclude by, and then I'll talk about maybe some applications of these things.
OK, so before I talk about the pseudo part, I want to talk about why random unitaries are something that we find interesting. So this is a huge list of applications. Actually, would it be better if these lights were off? Or can people see the screen OK?
Anyway, I'll let you figure that out. So here are some of the many things that random unitaries can do. Even though it fills the slide, it's still only a partial list.
I just want to try and briefly explain some of these. The first two are really just fancy ways of saying that random unitaries can create random lighting. They can that random unitaries can create other other kinds of randomness. And in that sense, they're some of the more general. A random unitary is one of the more general kinds of randomness you can have. So, for example, let's say you want to create a random pure state. Well, you could start with a fixed state, like the zero state, and apply a random unitary to it, and then you have a random pure state. Or let's say you want to do a random von Neumann measurement, then you can apply a random unitary and then measure in the computational basis, and that gives you a random von Neumann measurement. If you want a random overcomplete measurement, you could adjoin some ancillas in the all zero state, do a random unitary on the whole thing, and then measure, and that gives you a random overcomplete rank one measurement. So maybe there's more general kinds of randomness, but random unitaries are pretty general. In terms of actual applications, one of the most simple things they can do is randomize quantum states. I'll talk about this more in a little bit, but imagine you want to do, think of the scenario of the one-time pad. There's other cases it's useful, but this is the most basic. Alice and Bob share some random bits. Alice is a random state. She wants to use their shared randomness to scramble, and then she'll send this state to Bob. Since he has the same random bits as her, he can unscramble it, you know, invert the unitary she applies, and to an adversary who doesn't have access to their shared randomness, the state should look, sorry to repeat the same word, the state should look nearly random. It should look maybe maximally mixed in either the L1, L2, or infinity norm, which seems maybe like a boring distinction, but turns out to be quite important. More exciting application maybe is data hiding. This is something completely, something non-quantum, I'm sorry, non-classical essentially, which is that you can have information which is accessible globally, but not to two parties who are allowed to communicate classically. Another uniquely quantum thing you can do is information locking, which I'll talk about more in a little bit. a number of coding theorems can be done just using random unitaries. So even all the permutations, so not just sending quantum information through quantum channels, but sending through multiple access or broadcast channels, doing entanglement-assisted channel coding, and so then with some massaging, you can even get back the HSW theorem, as well as some of the more advanced recent stuff like state merging, entanglement distillation, the quantum reverse Shannon theorem, all are based on coding theorems that use random unitaries. So it's often important that we can implement them. Another information theory application I won't talk about is remote state preparation, where Alice transmits a state to Bob more cheaply by having an exact classical description of the state instead of merely holding it. And finally, one that isn't really about hard distributed unitaries, but one, let's say we have a Hamiltonian and we can create a random unitary within the set of unitaries that roughly preserves energy. If we could do this, then we could efficiently create a thermal state on a quantum computer, which is something that might be useful for simulation. Before I go on further, I want to say what I mean by random. I mean basically hard uniform, meaning that the distribution is invariant if you under left or right multiplication. We'll see later why this is a problem. For now, though, let's talk about happier things like what randomization is good for. So this is this result now is almost 5 years old. And it's not due to me, but it's a great result, which everyone should know about, so I want to talk about it. So state randomization is actually a good deal more exciting than just a one-time pad. And I'll show you why in a minute. The idea is that Alice wants, again, like I said, Alice and Bob share some randomness. Alice wants to encrypt the state by applying a random unitary to it, and then Bob will decrypt. And this, you have to be a little bit careful here, because there's two different random choices going on. Their strategy will be the following. They'll choose unitaries, U1 through UN, D by D unitaries at random, and then they'll freeze this choice, and then it'll no longer be random. And I'll argue that for most choice of U1 through UN, it'll form a good state randomizer. And N here is slightly larger than D, the dimension. Then they'll form this state randomization map, which consists of choosing a random one of this set, U1 through UN, and applying it to the state. So to apply it, you need a random number from 1 through N. You don't need the huge amounts of randomness to pick these guys. And the result of these papers is that this provides a good state randomizing map. In particular, if you apply it to any quantum state, it's very close to the maximally mixed state in all of these different norms. So in the infinity norm, this means that all of the eigenvalues of this thing are within the range 1 plus or minus epsilon all over D. That's sort of the strongest version that implies this result about the 2 norm, which is harder to give a physical interpretation to. And in turn, it implies this result about the 1 norm, which says that you can't distinguish this thing from maximally mixed with advantage greater than epsilon. And to contrast with the exact randomization that we already know, if you pick one of the D squared Pauli matrices, then you can get epsilon equal to 0. And it's somewhat remarkable that for exact randomization, I should have said are necessary and sufficient for exact randomization. Exact randomization you can do with fewer than D squared, but if you are content to do it approximately, then immediately you get almost all the way down to D. So, think of this as you have a log d qubit message. Classically, a one-time pad for log d bits has to be log d bits. This says that quantumly, if you want an exact one-time pad, you need 2 log d bits. But if you are willing to settle for approximate, it's only slightly more than log d bits. So this is already medium remarkable. But I want to talk about a more surprising implication of this, which is, OK, so again, here are the parameters. You have this, here's your randomizing map. It's randomizing in the infinity norm, and the number of random unitaries you need is slightly larger than the local dimension. So the first consequence of this infinity norm randomization is that if you apply this to half of a bipartite state, then it doesn't fully destroy correlations, but it at least destroys all the correlations that Alice and Bob can observe using LOCC. And the proof of that is super simple. It basically, any LOCC measurement is a separable measurement, so the measurement operators are of this form. And if we consider, we can consider E acting on the state, or we can consider its adjoint acting on measurement operators, and it looks basically the same thing. It's still just a mixture of random unitaries, just they're all daggers now. And if you apply it to this thing, to the measurement operator, then it approximately scrambles this this operator A, and so the result is very close to a measurement that which could be done entirely on Bob's side. In other words, anything that you can learn from an LOCC measurement, Bob could also learn without any communication from Alice. And so that means that the correlations are inaccessible to LOCC up to this error epsilon, and you can check that this condition with epsilon over D is what you need to make this epsilon, you know, make it so that you can't get more than epsilon advantage with LOCC. So this maybe isn't very surprising. After all, if you apply a random poly to half of a maximally entangled state, then the whole thing becomes maximally mixed. So it's not surprising that if you apply basically a ton of different random unitaries to one side of a bipartite state, then you should maybe completely destroy this entanglement and give you something that's maximally mixed everywhere. However, this is not actually what happens. That you have, when you apply this randomizing map to half of a maximally entangled state, you actually get something that's very far from the globally maximally mixed state. And the reason is the rank of this density matrix is n, at most n, and that's far less than d squared. And so, so it has to be very far from the totally maximally mixed state. And in fact, with only a slightly more work, you can find that you can, in fact, pack in many such operators. If you put in different maximally entangled states here, then you can get almost d squared over n different such states, which are each one LOCC indistinguishable, and yet globally orthogonal. So this phenomenon is known as data hiding, that we can get d squared over n, which is almost d, because n is just a little bit more than d, states that are mixed and globally orthogonal, but locally indistinguishable. So we go from, you know, at the beginning, you might, all this sounded like is, okay, a quantum one-time pad is only a little bit less efficient than a classical one-time pad, but you end with this remarkable, uniquely quantum phenomenon of data hiding. I guess classically, it's only possible with computational assumptions and more than two parties. So another even more surprising application is when, same story where you have a randomizing map, but now n is going to be much smaller. N is going to be polylogarithmic in D instead of slightly more than D. And there's this technical restriction epsilon, which I have to put in to be honest, but you can mostly ignore it. And again, think of the setting of the one-time pad. So Alice has a message, x, which ranges from 1 through d. Alice, and they share a key, k, which ranges from 1 through n. And they'll encrypt the message by applying u sub k, where again, the u's are chosen randomly once and then frozen. Now, classically, so this sort of resembles the situation of one-time pad, except we know that for a one-time pad, the key has to be at least as long as a message. So what are we doing here? I mean, the key is just polylogarithmic number of bits. That sounds like a logarithmic number of bits. It seems like a terrible way to do a one-time pad. You know, we know that this few resources definitely can't give information theoretic security. And in fact, the holovo information between x and q is near maximal. So the quantum mutual information between these two registers is quite large. So you might think an adversary who gets her hands on Q can learn a lot about X, that if she does the right measurement, then she can get a good deal of mutual information about this message. just like she could do if this were a classical one-time pad. And surprisingly, that's not possible. And there's two different ways of interpreting this, depending on what language you prefer. I guess it should be English or French here, but I don't know if I can say this in French. So what I will say is, even though the holovo information is large, the accessible information, which is defined to be the largest classical mutual information that can result from measuring these two systems. So maximize over measurements of Q, the mutual information between X and the measurement outcome, that accessible information is very small. And so we say that the information about X is locked by K. And it's locked because without K, you can't get very much accessible information. And if you have K, of course, you can just undo this unitary and learn everything about X, which unlocks it. So there are different ways to interpret what this means, depending on your disposition. Sort of the quantum information boosterism way to say it is that we get exponentially shorter one-time pads, that instead of a one-time pad being the length of the message, we can get away with having it be just logarithmic length. Pessimistically, we can say that this is a sign that accessible information is a bad way to prove security. We'd like our security definition to be stable in that if the adversary knows a little bit about our message, then if she learns a couple more bits, then she doesn't suddenly know the whole thing. And this says that accessible information is a lousy security definition by that standard. Or if you want to be neutral about it, you can just say this is a statement about entropic uncertainty relations, which are an interesting subject in their own right. Okay, so random communitaries let's do all these wonderful things. Unfortunately, like I suggested before, this is not really, we can't actually implement them. So even if in our head we could choose, you know, 4 to the n random complex numbers that form the unitary matrix, if we want an epsilon mesh for the set of unitaries, it'd be very large. And so even if we were optimally clever, it would still take a very long circuit to produce them. And this is not nothing quantum at all about this. I mean, the same is true for classical functions. So, and we also, okay, maybe we could approximate a random unitary, but we can't even approximate with an epsilon for any non-trivial values of epsilon. I mean, epsilon has to be like 2 before we can get a reasonable, before we can approximate with a polynomial number of gates. So instead of approximating in the sense of operator distance, let's approximate in the sense of moments. So what if we could instead pick random unitaries from some distribution which match the Haar uniform unitaries up to, let's say, the first k moments. So these are called k designs, the distribution mu on the unitary group, which has the property that, informally speaking, it looks random if you have at most k copies. Or you could say that its first k moments are the same. So there's, to be more precise about this, there's 3 mathematically equivalent definitions, which I'll switch between them as is convenient. The first one is nice because it just refers to a single, there's only one operator you have to evaluate. This operator is k copies of u and k copies of u star. That's just complex conjugate, not transpose also. And it says that if you take the expectation of this over mu, it's exactly the same as taking the expectation over the Haar measure. And this is equivalent also to talking about matrix elements. So if you take, I'm sorry, to polynomials. So if you take matrix elements of these, then you get a degree k monomial in the uijs and a degree k monomial in the uij stars. And so it says that all of those are equal as well. Equivalently, we can talk about applying k copies of the unitary to some quantum state and say that that should be the same whether or not we draw u from the Haar measure or from a particular distribution. And one special case that often comes up is when k is equal to 2, so there's 2 copies of the state, then this means that we get the same result when we, let's say we apply u to the state, put it through a channel, and then apply u dagger. then we should get the same thing whether, again, whether we draw u from the Haar measure or from this particular distribution. This thing, this task is known as twirling, and it says that this distribution suffices for twirling. Okay, so these are exact k designs. We'll also want to talk about approximate k designs, and I don't actually know if there's, I don't think there's a canonical definition of these. In part because they haven't been used for that many things, and so really people should just pick the approximation that's sufficient for their application. I think a reasonable definition is to look at this operator and say they should differ, have small difference in the one norm. So you add up the difference of their eigenvalues and it should be small. But I'm not wedded to this definition, it's just there for concreteness. Okay, so this is the first sort of pseudo-random tool we have. Some variants which are also worth considering. The classical analog of this, you might think of k-wise independent hash functions. Probably a closer analog is a k-wise independent permutation. So it's a permutation of d letters such that if you take any subset of k of them, it looks like a uniformly random permutation. And there's efficient constructions about this. And another analog which there also exist efficient constructions of are state k designs. So you can get them from a unitary k design by, basically they're what you get if you apply a unitary k design to k copies of any fixed state. Another way to say this is there are distribution over pure states such that k copies of them looks the same as k copies of a state drawn from the Haar measure. And when I write psi without the bra or ket around it, I mean the rank one projector on the psi. So these are variants of k designs. Another thing that's sort of in this whole pseudorandom constellation, which is, I guess, the link between me and many of the other talks here, are quantum expanders. Robert mentioned this morning the sort of combinatorial nature of expanders, that if you have a message on it, that it spreads rapidly. And this is sort of why they're called expanders. If you have any set and you look at the edges pointing out of it, it expands a lot. You know, there are many, it has many neighbors outside of that set. I'm going to talk only about the spectral definition of an expander, which is that it's gapped. So classically, an expander is a graph where the random walk matrix on the graph has constant gap. And the quantum analog of this is if we have a distribution, again, we have a distribution mu over the unitaries, such that this operator has a constant gap relative to the same operator if you draw u from the Haar measure. And to be a little bit more concrete about that, we should look a little more carefully at this operator. First of all, so this, since it's an average over the Haar measure, it has to be proportional to a projector. And in fact, it's a rank one projector. It's just the projector onto the maximally entangled state. And this state is fixed by all unitaries of the form u tensor u star. So no matter what this distribution is, it's going to have at least one eigenvector equal to one, which is going to be this state. It's going to be fixed by it. And then if it's gapped, then we'd like the rest of the spectrum to be less than or equal to lambda, some real number strictly less than one. So in this sense, we say that this distribution over unitaries is gapped, just like a random walk on a classical expander graph would also be gapped. You should stop me if you have any questions on any of these things.
Between the unitaries and a graph of some kind, or no, are you just talking about the fact that there are gaps in both senses?
So the unitaries could exist independent of any graph. In particular, so classically, it's an interesting question. So classically, you can think of a collection of permutations of d elements such that they, they have this mixing property. And there's an obvious graph where the degree of the graph is equal to the number of permutations. And here, I'm going to say the degree of the expander is the size of the support of mu. You know, mu is a distribution over L objects, and the degree is L. Which hopefully should be a constant, just like we talk about constant degree classical expander graphs. The thing is, though, the unitaries can have all of their matrix elements. You know, each unitary can have all non-zero matrix elements if you want, unlike a classical permutation, which is mostly full of zeros. And so in that sense, it makes it harder to come up with a clean combinatorial interpretation of a quantum expander. That should be, that's a good open question, a good open, broadly defined research topic, which is for classical expanders, we get a lot of mileage out of the connection between spectral gap and combinatorial expansion property. Can we get similar kind of mileage out of quantum expanders? We kind of hope so. I mean, that's part of the motivation for researching them, but haven't found very much there yet. When you look at this, it looks kind of like the last slide with two differences. First of all, it's infinity norm difference instead of one norm difference. Also, it's just U tensor U star. And in the last slide, I had U tensor K tensor U star tensor K. So if you combine them in a natural way, you get something which we have the, and I feel I should apologize for this name because it's somewhat awkward. But a K tensor product expander, which is something still a distribution over unitaries, but such that if you take K copies of them in this nature, in this form, then you get something which is sort of like an expander. It's not exactly an expander because the fixed space here is one dimensional, and here the fixed space is going to be bigger. It's going to be roughly dimension, it'll be dimension K factorial until K gets bigger than D. But it's the same story. There's a fixed space which is fixed by all unitaries of the form U tensor K tensor U star tensor K. So it's also going to be fixed by any distribution. And then the rest of the spectrum should be bounded strictly away from that. So in this case, we say it's a K tensor product expander. And you might ask, and one thing to notice is that if it's a K tensor product expander, then it's a monotonic property. So if it's a 10 tensor product expander, it's also a 9 tensor product expander. And so you might ask for a sort of universal one that's a tensor, K tensor product expander, no matter how large you make K, or an infinity tensor product expander. And this is something I'll return to, but this is equivalent to this being an expander on the group algebra of U of D. So you can think of performing a random walk on the unitary group, where you start with some unitary and you multiply by a random one from your generating set. And if this walk mixes rapidly, then mu gives an infinity tensor product expander. And I'll come back to this point in a minute. I want to first summarize how these concepts fit together. So the number of copies, if it's one, then we have a quantum expander, or an approximate one design, depending on whether we're looking at operator distance or trace distance. K copies is an approximate K design, or a K tensor product expander. And if something works for an infinite number of copies, then quantumly, there's something called an expander on the Cayley graph of the unitary group. Classically, this is an expander on the Cayley graph of the symmetric group. And there's no real analog for trace distance. If you take the number of copies larger, you either have the Haar measure or you have something where the trace distance is going to increase unboundedly. So in the expander language, we can get something interesting. In the approximate design language, harder to get an interesting, something interesting for the copy case of an arbitrarily large number of copies. And so expanders are, in a sense, weaker because we allow all of the eigenvalues to be off by a large amount, whereas here we want some of the eigenvalues to be off. But of course, there's a close relation between them in that
if you just exponentiate an expander, so just keep on applying it, then you get a you can get a design. And one thing which I didn't actually prepare a slide about, but it's in my recent paper with Matt, is that this can actually give the some of the most efficient known constructions of approximate one designs you can get just by repeatedly applying quantum expanders, which is somewhat surprising because you'd think you would give up. You'd think that just choosing a bunch of unitaries independently at random would be much better than picking maybe two or three and repeatedly applying them. But it turns out you don't lose very much when it happens. So one thing I want to talk a little bit more about are our K tensor product expanders, this this connection I mentioned before. So I basically want to justify what I said about how a K equals infinity tensor product expander is equivalent to a gapped walk on the group algebra. This is sort of the only slide where representation theory occurs. So don't get too dismayed if you're not a fan of the representation of the EREFs. So if this C bracket U of D is defined to be L2 functions on the unitary group, sort of distributions over unitaries, then it's a representation of the unitaries according to this group action of translation, basically. So f of x is a function on the unitaries, and g is just a unitary, and g acts on f of x by this translation operation. So it's a representation of the unitaries. So it can be broken up into EREFs. The trivial EREF shows up once. That corresponds to the uniform distribution, which is invariant under any rotations. But it turns out that every other EREF shows up at least once. This is a property of the unitary group, that every EREF shows up as you make K larger and larger, at least up to some overall phase, it shows up in some state of this form. So what this means is that all of these concepts are equivalent, being rapidly mixing on the unitary group, being gapped when you act on the group algebra of the unitary group, being an infinity tensor product expander, or having this operator be gapped for all non-trivial EREFs. So if you think of R of U as some EREF of the unitary group, and you average R of U over U drawn from your infinity tensor product expander, then the largest eigenvalue of this should be bounded strictly away from one. So if all these concepts sort of simultaneously, so basically any one of these things is equivalent to any of them being true. And the reason why I mention this is it gives us a way of thinking about, okay, so this is what happens when K is infinity, but it also maybe can help us think about what it means to have a K tensor product expander when K is not equal to infinity. So if K, basically, if K is finite, then this means that we can bound this largest eigenvalue for all EREFs showing up in U tensor K, tensor U star tensor K, for some low values of K. And what this means is that we have a random walk on the unitary group, which is rapidly mixing only above a certain length scale. Think of these EREFs as like Fourier coefficients, and as K gets larger and larger, you get finer and finer, the Fourier coefficients corresponding to faster and faster wiggles. And this says that it has a rapidly mixing property above some length scale, and then below that length scale, we don't give any guarantees. So so this means that even when K is not infinite, we can say something about being rapidly mixing on the unitary group up to some length scale. So more concretely, suppose we have a collection of unitaries where if you pick one at random, you get a K tensor product expander. And suppose K is big, but not infinite, then we get a sort of Solovey-Kataev-like result. That basically we find that the random walk associated with this is rapidly mixing until you get at least up to the length scale epsilon. And so you can approximate any unitary gate V with a this optimal string length of order log 1 over epsilon compared to this one that we can construct of log cubed of 1 over epsilon from the Solovay-Kataev theorem. So we don't know many applications of K tensor product expanders, but this is one of the few applications we know that it gives you rapid mixing on the unitary group if you're willing to settle for some approximation. So this is the only application of K tensor product expanders we know apart from K designs. But K designs we believe are actually useful in many things. Or at least I believe. But I think other people believe this too. So some of these applications we've already seen and we already know how to do. So L1 state randomization is basically a one design because we want to approximate applying unitary just once to a quantum state. Many results in coding require two designs. So creating quantum codes, this decoupling lemma, which is part of many coding approaches, entanglement generation, so just starting with an arbitrary state, applying a random unitary, and you should get something that's very entangled across any cut. This is also based on being a two design. So are these thermalization results. Twirling, I mentioned before. There's some results about random measurements where Haar uniform measurements give you something useful, but this can be simulated with just a four design. So these are the ones we know. And then there's some applications we still don't know how to do. And we believe they should be possible with higher values of K, but haven't yet been able to show it. So locking and L infinity state randomization don't appear to work with K equals two designs, but since they work with the Haar uniform unitaries, at some point, having enough moments matched should do the job. We just don't know exactly how that'll work. Remote state preparation and superdense coding of quantum states are more subtle. There's some sense in which two designs do part of the task, but not the whole thing. It appears that the designs will be part of the story, but we're not quite sure how to complete it. And since I guess we're running a little bit late and I don't want to compete with your lunch too much, I won't actually go in the details of why two designs give you entanglement generation, other than to say that the proof proceeds via the Reinier 2 entropy, which is a lower bound for the von Neumann entropy. And so from that, applying a random unitary from a two design gives you almost as much von Neumann entropy as applying a random unitary from the Haar measure. And if you ask me about it after the talk, I can tell you more about it if you want. So I want to summarize a little bit what we know about these things, about how to make efficient designs and efficient expanders. So before I just talk about why, you know, what they are and why they're useful, but what about how to create them? We like it so that on n qubits, you can create them in time polynomial in n. And in a few cases, we've solved this. So for one designs, it's always worth remembering that we have exact ones from the polys. And sometimes we don't mind spending two n random bits instead of the optimal n plus a little bit random bits. Or if we choose subsets of the polys carefully, then we can get this almost down to n bits. For two designs, we again have an exact two design. Oh, I should say exact two designs. They're also exact one designs, but that's less exciting. So we can, if we pick a random Clifford gate, then we get an exact two design. And there are a number of ways of putting together random quantum circuits to give approximate two designs using, depends on your notion of approximation, but it can be as small as order n random bits to get a good approximate two design. But for K larger than two, we still don't know how to do an approximate K design. And I have some ideas, which I'm working on with my student Richard and with Matt, but they haven't worked out yet. Expanders are something we do know how to do efficiently now. The first construction was random unitaries, which are not efficient, but it's worth knowing that they give sort of the optimal expansion parameter, this second largest eigenvalue lambda goes roughly like one over the square root of the number of unitaries. And it's cute that it, showing this was actually much easier than showing it for classical random graphs. So Jens, I guess, will not speak about this. I don't know where Jens is. Okay. So I'll only speak about it only a bit. But it's a quantum version of this classical Margulis expander, which is this really nice construction on the, basically the affine group on in two dimensions. He was able to show that the gap is basically at least as good as in the classical case. All these constructions really are sort of classically inspired. The classical zigzag product can also be generalized to, there's a very natural quantum generalization, which also uses quantum expanders. I have this representation theory based way of taking a classical Cayley graph expander and turning it into a quantum expander. And one thing that appeared in my recent paper with Matt is a way of taking a classical two-copy tensor product expander and making a quantum expander from this. Now, I'll explain how this works because it's maybe helpful to see the connections between these things. If you have a classical two-copy tensor product expander and you apply it to a quantum density matrix, then already it's a classical expander, so it's going to randomize the diagonal. But since it's a two-copy tensor product expander, it'll also randomize the off-diagonal terms. And it'll preserve the fact that I is not equal to J, in other words, that they're off-diagonal. But otherwise, it'll randomize it over all ket I broad J with I not equal to J. So instead of having a single fixed point, which is the identity, you have two fixed points, which is the identity along the diagonal, but also this mixture of all of the off-diagonal terms. So we almost give you a quantum expander. You just need to apply pretty much any old phase, like a sigma z on the first qubit will already do the job, to kill off these off-diagonal terms. And then putting that together, you get a quantum expander. So quantum expanders were, we're getting the hang of producing them. Efficient K tensor product expanders and K designs, I want to tell you my ideas. They're in various stages of half-baked. There's random quantum circuits. With Richard, we showed that they give a good two designs. And there's also some other work about this. We think they should also give good K designs. This is true classically, but we haven't proved it quantumly. This construction of a quantum tensor product expander from a classical two-copy tensor product expander, we think this should generalize to K copies as well. But there's some issues, and we haven't gotten them to work out. And Matt and I are working on generalizing the zigzag product to K tensor product expanders. Again, there's some issues here and getting to work out. I strongly believe that one of them will work out. You should, I think you should all go out and find applications of K designs and K tensor product expanders, assuming that they will very soon be efficient. Don't start any startup companies based on it yet.
Okay, so
I should wrap up and give us all time to eat, but I want to just, since this talk is sort of, it's been sort of a survey, and the perspective to result ratio has been high, I should give you some perspective on future work. So I think efficient constructions of these things would be exciting and is hopefully imminent. And then we should figure out how to apply it to some of these key problems, like doing L infinity state randomization. So those efficient one design constructions I mentioned, those give good L1 and L2 state randomization. But for some of the exciting applications like information locking and remote state preparation, we believe we need L infinity state randomization. So there is actually some practical application to this. So random circuits, we study them because they kind of resemble, we like to think they resemble things that might happen in the real world. You have a bunch of spins and they're undergoing some kind of semi-random interaction with the environment. But if there were some Hamiltonian models of this, it would be somewhat more plausible. And Jens also had some work here, which you're definitely not talking about that, right? But it's a pretty intriguing open direction. This quantum finding the creating a Gibbs state in a quantum computer I mentioned earlier as being something that'd be interesting, like a version of the Metropolis algorithm, which let's say always converges, but we just can't always bound how quickly it does. Frank Bertrati, I think, had some preliminary results here, and I forget who his co-authors are. And finally, classically, there's something called a Ramanujan expander, meaning that the relationship between the gap and the degree is optimal. And quantumly, the same bounds exist. You know, that the gap can't be better than such and such for any fixed degree. And this is achieved by random unitaries. But of course, the theme of this talk is that we can't do this efficiently. And all of those efficient expander constructions that I showed you were not Ramanujan, unlike the classical case where we do know how to do efficient Ramanujan expanders. So it'd be nice if we could figure out a quantum way to do this. And this would in turn give us, we'd be able to do these optimal L1 state randomization procedures efficiently. So I'll leave it at that. Thanks for your attention.
So these infinite tensor product expanders.
Yeah.
I mean, forgetting efficient constructions, do you have any constructions of them?
Yeah.
With, I guess I should say, with finite degree.
So classically doesn't count. Then classically, K only needs to be as large as D. And it was very recently proven that there exist efficient expanders on the symmetric group. So that's sort of the classical thing that's proven. Quantumly, for D equals 2, this Lubotsky, Phillips, and Sarnak expander, basically, you rotate about the x, y, or z axis by plus or minus theta, where theta is some fixed angle, like r cosine of this. So that was this construction that was known for a while. So this happens to be an expander for D equals 2. Recently, it was proven that that a much larger class of collections of unitaries in D equals 2 gives you an expander. Basically, if you have any universal set of gates in U of 2 where the matrix entries are algebraic, that also gives you a K equals infinity expander. But it's proving all these things is really difficult. And proving they exist for D greater than 2 is unknown. There's a really natural conjecture, which is that if you pick unitaries at random, then with probability 1, you get an expander on the unitaries. And you can get probability 1 because you demand only that there be a non-zero gap, you know, not that it be any particular value. I think this is believed, but considered hard to prove. And I guess from these D equals 2 constructions, you can make constructions for higher values of D. The gap just gets worse and worse. So we do know they exist for any value of D. But with what gap and, you know, how often, you know, and what things look like that is still open. Yeah.
Could you say a few more words maybe on creating the Gibbs state on the quantum computer? So you mean like applying the same completely positive map and that you get quick convergence to a Gibbs state that's not maximally mixed upon iteration of that map? Is that the...
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be applying the same map over and over again, but that's a plausible way to do it. That's, yeah, the sort of the most reasonable way anyone sort of has talked about. But yeah, the idea is you want to make e to the minus beta h. Obviously, you can't do that for all values of beta, or you could solve, you know, QMA problems. Just like classical, you can't do it for all values of beta, or you could solve NP problems. But for sort of reasonable values of beta, you'd hope the thing could work. That's pretty much it. Yeah.
So this question is about the amount of randomness required to generate a random unitary. So we know in classical case, It takes an exponential number of bits to generate a random function. But if I have a classical circuit that makes use of a random function, I don't need to specify the whole function. So whenever I need a random bit, I need a random entry in the function's truth table. If the entry is not produced before, then I just toss a coin. Otherwise, I just got a table that of entries I produce. Right? So therefore I need only a small number of random bits to generate what I a random function. Being happy with the computation that a circuit does. So is there a similar analogy in quantum case?
That's like the best justification for K designs I've heard. Yes, definitely. If I give it time again, I'm gonna put that in there. Yeah. So let's say you have a quantum circuit, you have a black box unitary, and you apply the circuit using a unitary only once. Well, you could have just that unitary didn't have to be fully random. It could have just been poly, right? And if you're applying it once, who's gonna know the difference? And if you're applying it only k times, you can put in an approximate k design.
Okay.
So that's thanks for that. Because
okay.
You know, k copies means that when you write it out, all the inner products are just degree k polynomials of the U and U dagger matrix elements.
This is assuming that you're using the trace norm to evaluate the statistical difference to evaluate the outcomes, right?
Yeah. Which is reasonable for one, think of this thing as being applied once. Yeah.
You said you could get efficient designs by exponentiating expanders.
Yeah.
And you said you wouldn't lose much as compared to creating them randomly. Can you be a bit more precise what you mean by not losing much?
So what you need is for a design you want the trace distance to be less than epsilon. So let's say there are d eigenvalues and have to add up to less than epsilon, and you apply the expander. Is there some chalk somewhere? So let's say the expander has second largest eigenvalue lambda. You apply it n times. Then this should be less than or equal to epsilon over d. And then you get a design. So n has to be like log of the degree of log of d over epsilon if divided by log of 1 over lambda. So if this is a constant, this will be proportional to log of d. And log of d, remember, is sort of the order of what we want for state randomization. If you look carefully at, so if you have lambda scaling, like for the optimal expanders, the Ramanujan ones, lambda should scale like 1 over the square root of the degree of the expander. So you have, on the one hand, this means you need fewer iterations in order to achieve this. On the other hand, each iteration costs you more random bits. But these factors pretty much cancel out. And you end up with getting state randomization with d over epsilon squared times a little bit. Like I think 4 times d over epsilon squared, unitaries are needed for L1 state randomization if you have one of these optimal values of lambda. So this is my recent paper with maps, where there's spelled out in more detail. There's some really annoying things we were unable to resolve. Like that factor of 4 shouldn't be there, but there's this issue with singular values versus eigenvalues that we're unable to address. So it'd be nice if someone could figure that out.
Questions?